So I started taking ADD medication again.
Okay, cool. How is that?
Really good. Really, really, really good. I love amphetamines.
Okay.
And I'm ready to rock. Let's go.
Yeah, this is really like good. Riding a bike. I'm spitting the wine today, so it's kind of like a medication. I'm not getting my medication, in fact. So yeah.
We'll see how this works.
I wish alcohol wasn't bad for us.
It's so fucking bad for you.
Is gorgeous. Like, I had a really nice dinner last night, and that's unfortunate that it was like the best dinner that I've ever had, and I can't feel like I'm healed from it.
Yeah.
Like,
The weird thing is, like, food can be that way too sometimes. Like, sometimes the best, like, I'll have an incredible meal, and I'll feel really bad the next day.
Yeah, we've been to Frenchette before.
Yeah, exactly. Frenchette was like a 3-day food hangover. Yeah,
terrible.
That's also to say that, like, things like sugar, how much is that actually food?
Yeah.
But alcohol definitely is food. I think we're all on, you know.
Certainly.
It's medicine.
Yeah.
It's the spice of life.
Exactly.
All right, let's get into it.
I've been so nervous about doing this because we haven't done a podcast. This is a month?
I think so.
Oh, wow.
It feels really weird. There's a layer of dust over all the equipment.
Uh-huh.
Welcome back, y'all. Yeah,
this is good.
There's like a empty sarcophagus full of juice I want to drink.
I mean, basically. Well, you know, fuck it. Hey, welcome. Hello. Welcome to Disgorgeous. It's a podcast about wine. My name is John McCarroll.
Just like riding a bike.
Just like riding a rusty fucking bike into traffic.
My name is Kevin. Our guest today is Ryan Williams, a New England farmer and winemaker.
Howdy, folks.
Thanks for... This is really your first time on the podcast?
This is my second time on the podcast, technically.
I wasn't there for one?
Yeah, it was a Patreon episode where I just meant to have a phone conversation with John, and it ended up being a 30-minute podcast where I broke down millennial society.
Oh, nice.
It was really, really, really well received by our mostly aging millennial Patreon listeners who love to be taken to task.
I don't listen to any of the things John does without me.
Well, there's an episode I just uploaded that has a click, and it's been 24 hours before someone told me about the fucking click.
Oh, so you threw me under the... I told you I would edit that episode that had the 30 seconds of silence at the beginning, and then you just posted it. And then when... Jim called you out. You said, I asked them to cut it as if like I was at fault.
That was a joke. I was never going to cut that fucking episode. Why would I cut? And I've never cut any of the episodes.
Yeah, that's why I'm here, guys. That's why I'm here.
Thank you for being here and at least making it not entirely terrible.
Yes. We do our best.
Yeah. I am the mids here to even everything out.
So this is the hybrid season. We're out here for it.
Yeah. Wow. I think, you can. We'll pitch this to you. Hybrid Theory. Do you remember that Linkin Park album?
No, that was not my cup of tea.
Is it? It's a Linkin Park album, right?
I think so.
Okay,
cool. I also did not listen to it.
Me either, but I know the cool kids did.
Yeah.
I guess we're all fucking losers.
I'm sick as shit, dude.
I was into the album that they did with Jay-Z.
Yeah.
Remember that?
That was so cool.
I never actually listened to it, but yeah. I remember it happening.
It was a moment. We were all there.
Yeah.
You know.
A hybrid moment. Now, there's a band I listen to.
I think we can work it. There's 7 weeks of this.
Yeah.
There's enough time.
And I guess this is currently Tuesday, right?
Still Tuesday, yeah.
So we have 6 days before we have to figure out what this is called, which is a really powerful feeling.
The power in our hands. Mm-hmm. So are hybrids.
Yeah.
So as I was saying before, as we get into this, I think that there's just some kind of like base acknowledgments that we should make about what we know about hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
If either of you would like to start, I'd love to hear what you do know about hybrids in its history, in its context, and the amount of hybrids that you potentially have tasted.
Yeah, that's a very important last question, because I think like I was talking to you before John got here because he was very late.
Go fuck yourself.
And I've been thinking about this. We've been playing this season for a while and thinking about doing what is now going to be like 7 episodes just on hybrids. And like, I think I'm having a bit of, as I think about hybrids in general, and I will answer your question eventually. I'm on ADD medication again.
Yeah.
So
it's making you more verbose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a bit of like, I don't want to say like PTSD because I don't want to like co-opt that. But like having grown up like mm-hmm. with you selling cider.
Yes.
And seeing like the cider movement. We were talking about this before. And then like even to a certain extent like the Paquette kind mm-hmm. of thing of 3 years ago. I'm like, oh no, everyone's getting really excited about hybrids. In 5 years, no one's going to talk about them anymore. Mm-hmm. Which is like what happened to cider and sort of what happened to Paquette, like, or is happening to Paquette. And it's like, I think it's too important for that to happen. And I really, really am excited and interested in seeing like what where the conversation does go. Mm-hmm. But I am worried, I think, that like, once again, everyone's going to be like, the cool new thing is hybrid grapes. And like, there's going to be all these articles
oversimplifying. 2 weeks over the fucking hype. It's going to happen this summer.
Right. And then, but then I don't want everyone to fucking forget about it. So to answer your question, I don't know enough about hybrids. My understanding always was, okay, it was Vinus vinifera blended with, I guess originally I just thought there was one American species of grape. But I know now there are more. But my understanding was always it was those two crossed, and then that they were created mostly in colleges in North America to try to create grape varieties that specifically were like less susceptible to frost. Because a lot of the ones I knew about were from upstate New York, because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. I went to Syracuse and we sold New York ciders, and mm-hmm. that was sort of the realm I knew. And past that, I didn't know much else until the last year, maybe.
Okay, how about you, John?
I've drank a lot of hybrids. A lot of them not knowing exactly what they were. Like, I feel like I've had a lot more... I found it very hard to distance hybrids from two things. One, very experimental wines, like people who are not wine professionals making wine.
Right.
And also people who make horrible wine, and it doesn't really matter what they have. So I've had a lot of like Finger Lakes hybrid wines that them being hybrid was entirely besides the point. They were just bad wine.
Right.
And I've had a lot of wines that were like interesting, but also the person who made them, this was their first or second time making wine. So it was very hard to kind of see the beauty through it. And so this is going to be, I think, my first systematic understanding of, or trying to like taste them against each other and rather than comparing them to vinifera.
Right.
And yeah, I have kind of got radicalized about the idea of winemakers, how much time they have in the day and like what they choose to spend their time on. And so I'm going to be thinking a lot about that with this. Like so many of these wines were sent to us by people who just started making wine, some of whom are not represented, most of whom are not represented in New York yet. And it's like, it's very weighty to just be like, these are people who are professionals, but at the beginnings of careers generally, with the exception of I think Deidre is probably the most venerable winemaker we're tasting this entire season.
And I think like this is the episode we're doing on New England. Mm-hmm. Most of these are from Vermont.
And this is the most fucking professional part of the hybrid season.
Right. And because a lot of these producers came from that kind of orbit. Mm-hmm. And I would say probably that her wines also were the first hybrid wines I can remember tasting.
Certainly. So, it seems as though you, John, are slightly aware of the history of hybrids, at least in Europe.
Very aware of it.
both of you did discuss, as far as I can recall, talking about the French hybrids mm-hmm. in the Loire.
Yeah.
Saint Croix, Lyon, Milo. Mm-hmm. There's also Maréchal Foch. Mm-hmm. That was hybridized in Alsace.
Yep.
I'm not sure if you had touched on things like that. But so as far as I go, I am from Massachusetts, born and raised, still live there, and predominantly farm and ferment in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. I do other work with grapes and consulting, helping some people out in Connecticut plant a new organic vineyard and winery. And I am, this is my fourth year of doing wine in the United States or in general. My first 2 years was on the West Coast mm-hmm. in Oregon and in California. And then in California, it was 2020. And, I learned a lot of fucked up things about yeah. like how to farm and ferment when it's on fire outside. And when everything is just at its most chaotic, I think. And when I came back home, I said, I do want to work with these grapes around me. I want to spend a full year with a grapevine. I wasn't sure what was around me, though. The more I looked into it, the more I realized that I was kind of in this in-between of a threshold where below Boston, it's warm enough to still grow vinifera, but above the line of Boston, the separating like half of Massachusetts above, then it becomes a colder climate zone. The hardiness of grapevines are less open to growing vinifera. Uh-huh. So when I started getting into it, I got connected with Nicholas Kimberly, mm-hmm. who was working at Shara Vineyards at the time up in Concord, New Hampshire. That's where we still are based. I joined in 2021 to spend a full year at the Grapevine, and we were farming predominantly Marquette, which we'll be tasting at the end of this episode. When I got exposed to all these hybrids, I said, wow, what I'm tasting, I didn't know much about the history of hybrids either. I was aware of Concord grapes. Mm-hmm. I was aware of pretty much Concord grapes was the only thing that like I first knew. Mm-hmm. And then the French hybrids, St. Croix, Lyon, Milot, mm-hmm. Sabrevoix. And then when I came up to New Hampshire, I learned essentially it just kind of like opened the floodgate for all the grapes there are all these things I'd never heard of before, all these things that I'd heard that people in Vermont were doing, but, you know, I didn't want to work all the way in Vermont. I barely even wanted to work in New Hampshire, but it's very close to my house, close enough at least, where it's possible to do in a day, it's accessible enough, and it's super not widely known. I would approach people all the time in New York pouring this Marquette, and it would say, would you want to try New Hampshire wine? And they'd turn around and say, there's New Hampshire wine? There are grapes in New Hampshire? Right. And yes, there's grapes in every single state in this country. And more so, there's becoming a culture around these things. But we're here to talk about hybrids specifically. So with hybrids, you know, again, its whole intention was that within these climate zones of kind of 5, 6 and colder, mm-hmm. Lower, you can still grow these grapevines that are hybrids of vinifera and even just taking native grapes and crossbreeding those as well, or just straight up taking native grapes and planting those. Right. The only example where we can see that is, can't remember his name, but out in one of the Dakotas, South Dakota, I believe, guy has taken all kind of like riparian, mm-hmm. Riparian vineyard and planted it, commercially. It's very cool.
There's also a couple, Morton is, of, no one's sure about the parentage, but people think that it might be native, and Muscadine as well. We have
Muscadine is native to southern states.
It's
right?
Like it's not a hybrid. I think we don't have a Morton because I did one on a Patreon episode, and we've got a Muscadine that we might open for the South episode, uh-huh. just because it's interesting. And we've got some Concord grape ones, which are like. Very debatable, but it's the idea is this is a not vinifera season.
Yes.
I'm not going to split hairs if there's like another cool grape.
I think Concord is hybrid. We were just talking about this.
Concord is a hybrid.
It's an old one though, right?
It's an old one that was hybridized in Massachusetts. So what I learned, as far as American history and the history of hybrids in the United States is that a lot of that was being done in Ohio, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and New York. As far as what comes out of it, the process for producing hybrids, for releasing hybrids, it is usually around a 20-year process.
In terms of experimenting with crosses, finding a cross that you think works, and then mm-hmm. having enough data to be like, okay, it did work or didn't work.
Is yeah. I mean, it essentially takes 3 years from planting for a vine to produce fruit anyways, right. at the soonest.
Right.
Can be anywhere from like 3 to 5 to even 7 years for a vine to start producing.
It's bizarre how many of them are successful given that Cornell is a dumb university full of bad people, which is like the craziest thing.
That's why a lot of the Cornell varietals that have been planted, mm-hmm. in my experience that I've seen being grown in New Hampshire, have died.
That's why we want Yale varietals. The ones that fucking study.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think the first time I ever heard like the term hybrid grape was when we were selling Aaron Burr's Abinett.
Yes.
Which was Treminet.
Yeah.
And then I was like, what the fuck is Treminet? And they're like, oh, it's a hybrid grape.
Well,
I went, uh-huh. And then I just like pretended I knew what that meant.
I grew hybrids for 4 years.
Right.
And I didn't know they were hybrids. I was working at a vineyard in the Hudson Valley and we grew a shit ton of Treminet. And I was like, I guess this one does well and the Chardonnay doesn't do well. But I was like, I was like medically grade high every single day in the vineyard. Like I got to drive a Gator. Do you have a Gator?
We have a Kubota.
Okay, is it as cool as a Gator?
No.
I had a fucking Gator. I was whipping around in there. Like,
Gators roll.
Just smoking weed, eating ice pops, and like just tucking all year. It was the fucking best. And so I had no idea I was working on hybrids.
Right.
They look but those, pretty similar.
They sprayed the shit out of them too. I got to be honest. They did not do a good job. There's also a grape called Black Malvasia, which I feel has got to be a hybrid.
Perhaps. Let's talk about let's start from the progression away from vinifera.
Uh-huh.
Let's start with Europe, where they were taking vinifera and crossing it with American hybrids. I mean, the reason why people started crossing American hybrids for the most part was because of phylloxera in the 1800s, right? So the whole dynamic of hybrids is that, you know, phylloxera is a huge cornerstone of the wine world and wine's history.
You can't tell the story of modern wine without talking about it.
Certainly.
It's affected every part of the industry to some extent.
So let's start there.
Yeah.
So phylloxera is a pest. It's a bug. Mm-hmm. That was brought from California to France and killed a huge majority of quote unquote old world's grapevines in order to replant these vineyards. Farmers had to graft vinifera onto American rootstock. So all of the vines that aren't, you know, 300 years old, are probably planted from grafts of American rootstock.
Yeah, you know when it isn't because people
they'll talk
about
tell
it.
You.
Yeah, it's like veganism.
It's like when people tell you about how they're doing kettlebells, which I'm doing these days.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's like you say, oh, it's own-rooted, and you're like, haha, I scored an extra point, yeah. Otherwise, you can assume that it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and It was something that was done and not talked about very widely, perhaps, because people wanted to have this air of purity, you know? Where
there's nothing a European hates more than, like, having impurity. To admit they needed something from impurity. Absolutely.
But to admit that they need something here. From Europe.
Fuck Europe. Let's go.
You spent 2 weeks in Austria, and you're like, no, actually, purity is very important, guys.
I just want to point out, it's crazy that they're the ones who lost World War II, and how much nicer life is there than here. Yeah. I was like, what the fuck?
It's fair.
It's like an Operation Paperclip of the economics. Sorry, go on.
If we lost, would we still have so much gun violence?
I don't like to do the hypothetical of what if we lost World War II, because that's like every history book ever written.
Yeah.
But we would probably have different kinds of violence.
Let's move along then.
Yeah.
So
that was a fun little
thought experiment.
So we're going to talk about specifically France, Austria, and Germany right now.
We do have an episode about all of those guys. So we can hop into New England if that's easier for you.
Well, I mean, let's just cover our bases. Let's make these beginning acknowledgments and just have a good foundation for the listeners to understand exactly where we are. I think all of this context is super important to talk about any of these.
Sure.
And I think we cannot do that without establishing that context and then moving on.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important that we do this work of acknowledging all these things before we move on.
Sure.
And that's so it was being grown, like, you know, hybrids were being grown all across the old world, all across the world, period. Mm-hmm. Everybody was farming and crossing and experimenting for centuries now at this point. Germany had a collective or consortium or some international organization called the Peewee. I'm pretty sure, John, you changed your name on Instagram about it. So
Peewee's not a hybrid. It's Peewees are hybrids bred with vinifera, so they're 75% vinifera.
Right. It's actually what I read is that German Peewee, P-I-W-I, stands for Pilzvita Stansfagi.
Mm-hmm. Classic thing we always say.
Yeah. It means fungal resistant, right?
Peewee International, founded in 1999. It's 550 members around 21 countries in Europe and North America, and it's at least 85% vinifera hybridized. So that's why I'm talking about let's start here to move away from vinifera. It is slow. We're still only in the 85% threshold right now. But they were making things like Muscarie, Cabernet Blanc, which I've certainly had Cabernet Blanc, but none of these other things. Sauvignon Gris, Sauvitage, Dono Riesling.
I've had all of them, yeah. I've actually had a lot of PV grapes.
Okay, cool. So that that's something that I had only learned recently about, and when I was discovering things, I was like, "Oh, Cabernet Blanc! Like, is that like what's going on here?" And realized that that's just essentially hybrids of vinifera.
Right.
As you go further from that, you see other things that were made like Saint Croix and Leon Milot and Marechal Foch that have a bit less vinifera in them. As you progress through.
But there was definitely like, you can tell that in Europe, the desire was to use as little non-vinifera as possible.
Right.
Because there's still, like you mentioned, this feeling of like, well, this, we invented making wine. They didn't. And so we need to keep it European. You know what I mean? At the very least, we have to do everything we can to make it as European as possible.
Like, I think that it's also important to note that the classic French hybrids that we're talking about came well before PV grapes. PV grapes is an attempt to essentially make hybrids repalatable to the European palate. Hybrids were ripped up across Europe for the idea that they caused infertility, that they were fucked up and foxy. The French had this propaganda in the Loire that it was poisonous. And it was because probably the biggest reason was that they didn't need as much chemical inputs.
Right.
And it was kind of a way of getting farmers kind of hooked on the good shit. But the PV grapes are an attempt to like essentially make vinifera that is just completely disease resistant and doesn't have all of the weirdness.
The character of hybrid.
And I've talked to a couple farmers in the States who are trying to bring PVs because like there is, I think, a barrier to entry with hybrids, which is they don't do what other grapes do. Like they are... Weird's a terrible way of saying it, but like, you know, this is a dumb podcast. They're weirder a lot of the times. Like, well, you get a lot of like funkier tastes.
What are we drinking now?
So let's talk about the flavor profiles of hybrids. So there's really three to keep in your head, three species of grape varieties to keep in your head that is not vinifera. So we start with Vinus vinifera at the canonical top.
S-tier.
And that is like the first species of grapes that most people are aware of.
Yeah.
There are also many, many more species of Vitis. There's Vitis labrusca, most commonly associated with the flavor of Concord.
Yeah.
That's the flavor that we're tasting now in this wine that is... some seedless Somerset seedless with some other Labrusca flavor grape profiles. And this is actually underripe Labrusca hybrids that have been macerated for like a month oxidatively, and it doesn't taste like any of those things at all. You just taste the general sort of white Concord kind of flavor to it with some tannins, some structure, and you really can't tell that it was actually underripe or macerated for this long.
It makes sense when you said it. It makes sense because it was surprisingly
structural.
Yeah, like green and structural, and not green in a negative sense, but like in like a cab franc sense or something. Hmm. Like green in a what I would think is a good way. In a way that I was sort of like surprised. So it's a bunch of different Labrusca hybrids.
Bunch of different Labrusca hybrids from this beautiful vineyard that looks at Vermont. It is still in New Hampshire. All of the wines that I brought are from New Hampshire.
And let's give a little shout out, huh? This is fabulous.
It really is.
This is the NOK Vino.
N-O-K Vino. Stands N-O-K. For not otherwise known, and it's okay to say NOK. It's totally fine however you choose to read it. So this is the farmer and winemaker who I work with up in New Hampshire, Nicholas Kimberly. Homies know him as Nico. He actually used to work with under Deirdre around 2018, 2019. He was living in Vermont. And he...
Oh, Jesus. I'm sorry.
I'm going to decline it. Yeah, who is it? I don't know. I also turn your volume down.
Yeah, you can also turn my internet off, which I always suggest we do. But you forgot to do it this time?
Moving on.
My computer, come on.
So Nico used to work with Deirdre La Gargista. That was actually his first wine job.
Yeah.
And he's from New Hampshire. And this is the kind of wine circle he's been in. The whole time he's been working with hybrids.
So he never started with any Vinifera.
Started as far as farming and fermenting. Never started with Vinifera. Oh, it's fine. I can just sweat.
I'm sweating.
Oh, okay, cool.
I'm for the reader. This is the hottest day of the fucking year.
It's actually 95 degrees outside, really, and it's the end of May.
Right now. Oh my god! Yeah, this is actually the only time we've ever done this right.
Yeah.
Historically, on the hottest day of the year, we're like, let's have some Barolo. So
honestly, the Marquette that we're going to drink at the end of this is going to make you wish that we didn't have to drink it on a 95 degree day. But it is going to be delicious and transformative and educational.
That's what we want.
And it's fine. I already took a shower. I'll take another shower after this. That is, again, an affirmation I'm making, a promise. I will be taking a shower after this because I already have booze sweats.
So I wanted to say a couple of things about this wine while we're talking about it. And it's... I turned the Wi-Fi off unless you were trying to do it. A couple of thoughts I had. We're talking about preconceived notions about what hybrid grapes taste like, or the idea that they're weirder or take more getting used to. But this is, like, I think a good example, and maybe there's a number of reasons why this is happening. But, like, to me, the winemaking decisions here, the idea to pick early, the idea to blend instead of using a single varietal, have helped to create a wine that drinks, to me, a little bit less hybrid-y than I might expect. There is certainly that, like, White Concord grapiness that you sometimes get, but that's not that out of the ordinary. And there's, like...
There's a lot of florality to it.
Absolutely, yeah. There's, like, an aromatic quality, and I just think that there's... A lot of times, what I think when people talk about hybrid grapes in a negative sense is exactly what John was saying before, is, like, if they've had it... They've had it in the hands of people that didn't know what they were doing or who were trying to treat it like Vitis vinifera.
Yes.
Or just had like learned a bunch of bad tricks for like growing a different fucking species of grape and then trying to apply those to this species. And I think the fact that he hadn't ever learned those bad habits by working with Vitis vinifera like for a long time probably helped to make some winemaking decisions that honestly aren't that out of the ordinary. I mean, picking early is what they've done in Champagne for fucking ever for a good reason, you know? Like,
again, like the majority of hybrids in this country are grown like in places like the Finger Lakes at vineyards that people don't actually like that just have to make wine.
Right.
They make wine for local consumption. You know, like I've met so many farmers like, oh, you got to try our Leon Mayo. And I'm like, oh, everyone else likes it. And like, well, okay, no one else likes wine here. So that's, but like, there is a lot of, like, I mean, really, like, I don't like to be, like, do a hagiography here, but, like, before 2008, before Deirdre, there was really not that many people who were seriously saying, I am going to make hybrid wine. I'm going to make I'm going to make wine for people who talk about wine.
Right.
And again, you guys can tell me maybe I am wrong. I would love to be wrong, but I think that's kind of the story so far.
Well, if you know Deirdre's story, it's actually, she started making wine, like, it was kind of forced upon her. She didn't actually choose to make wine her first harvest. She was farming organically a vineyard that was all hybrids, and she was taking care of it around 4 acres or so, farming it all on her own and selling it off to other people. And then through people not wanting to buy organic fruit, mm-hmm. it was forced upon her that she had to start fermenting it all on her own.
Sure.
And that's
because that's your investment at that point. You can't let the grapes just.
Yeah. That is why she started making wine. And she, through that happenstance, has become the reference point for farming and fermenting organic hybrids in New England. Mm-hmm. The mentality, the commercial, conventional mentality of most winemakers that I've experienced throughout New England want to make sweet white wines and big dry red wines that taste like California, that's right. trying to taste like France.
Good fucking
like,
luck, yeah.
None of us can actually do that. And they're pitching with like mostly Burgundy yeast.
Yeah. Classic thing Burgundians love to do, pitch yeast.
The amount of times that I've listened to people say, why isn't my Monrachet yeast working with my like Chambersun is silly.
Those are, yeah.
Yeah.
That entire phrase is my safe word.
We should move to wine number two because we are, but I do want to say I really like this.
Mm-hmm. Let's make one more acknowledgement while we're still in the Labrusca corner.
Yeah.
Because let's talk about foxiness. I think this is the only time that we're going to have the opportunity to talk about foxiness.
I can't taste fox.
I think that the dynamic of foxiness that people refer to it as is kind of like very musky. Mm-hmm. And I can understand that in the worst versions of it, what my experience of like bad foxiness has tasted like is a mixture of coffee and animal piss.
Mm.
And that's not very tasty, but I promise you these other ones are. What some people have been able to figure through working with this like, you know, Concord grape, like musky flavor is either not doing a lot of skin contact, like Deirdre's direct press, mm-hmm. Brianna, which is absolutely delicious. I think she really figured
that
out.
I've heard great things about that.
Yeah. There's also carbonic maceration, just not a lot of contact with the skins. But what both Nico and what I have done with, my Labrusca grapes is that we've actually did prolonged skin contact and oxidative fermentation,
mm-hmm.
Because Labrusca honestly loves air. Labrusca does love air if you give it air. You can also taste the Chipica Concord Nouveau. Mm-hmm. They're probably not giving a lot of air, but they probably did like a carbonic maceration and quick pressing to also not make it taste like coffee and cat piss. And I think we've all done a wonderful job in that. In the natural wine world to figure out what works for us, what kind of wine we want to make in that way. And that is generally not the end all be all of Labrusca, but a really good place to start and end for now, because I think that there's many more people who are going to try just trying to mess around with different flavor profiles of Labrusca and see what can work if mm-hmm. you blend it with certain things, if you direct press, if you do these prolonged macerations, that we're all going to be able to taste more quote unquote serious. And when I say serious, I mean not too sweet or fruity or too like, you know,
silly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that is very powerful with Labrusca, that in its nature can probably taste like something that really evokes memories from childhood, probably.
Yeah. Well, it's just like anything else, you know, this conversation. I think that the hybrid, the modern hybrid movement that maybe we're talking about happens to be kind of in lockstep with the natural wine movement in general. And there's something sort of in common here, which is like, there's preconceived notions of like how there was a little bit of wine in there already.
Okay.
Maybe that's fine.
It's probably okay.
And of like how like winemaking should happen that have to be unlearned. But it's also like, you know, that's a process like learning how to make unsulfided wine after decades of people being told the only way to make good wine is to sulfite the fuck out of it. It's like, you know that there's an unlearning that has to happen, and that unlearning can happen, but it's a process, and it needs to be allowed to happen. You can't just say, well, there's no turning back, like we've crossed the threshold. Like there, because otherwise, you know, everything's going to die.
Certainly. There's
but now nothing will die.
Now nothing's going to die. We will live forever.
Yep, we figured it out. After COVID, we figured out how to live forever.
I have like so many Elden Ring jokes I shouldn't make. This is interesting. So this wine is one.
Moved on to wine number two now. We are no longer in Labrusca land. We are now switching over to the third kind of grape species that you should have in your head, Vitis riparia. Riparia means riparian, can grow along riverbanks, is another species of native grape to the United States that has always been here and has been hybridized with different French grapes. Specifically, what we're drinking now is a Frontenac Gris, which was hybridized in the University of Minnesota. Just to touch back on the history of the University of Minnesota, they began grape breeding in the 70s commercially and opened their Enology Research Winery in 2000 at the Horticultural Research Center, 12,000 experimental vines on 12 acres, and that is where most of these hybrids that we are tasting have originated from.
So this is a gift from a listener. I traded him some wine and I got him a t-shirt. But I, a confession, I've actually never really liked Deirdre's wines. I've always had them too young. And someone kind of keyed me in that I think Deirdre probably drinks different wine than I do. And a lot of her references were different. She quite likes big old Rhone wines. And I think she likes white Rhones, which I know Kevin likes those, but not particularly my style. And something I was kind of thinking is, you can't understand this region. You can barely understand hybrid wines without her, I think. So I looked for something with just a couple years of age, trying to see if that would maybe be the key. And I really like this. So far, it kind of tastes like the whisper of a Coke Zero across the room.
So this is a 2019 Frontenac Gris. Frontenac is... primarily riparia flavor profile to it. If you'd like to look up the parentage diagram on Chateau Strip Mine, Kevin,
I had not heard of this website before.
It's called Chateau Strip Mine?
It's such a good name.
That's so sick.
You can find parentage diagrams for a lot of American hybrids on there.
I turned the Wi-Fi off. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a problem.
We'll take your time with it.
But I had it pulled up. This is for Frontenac?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And your question was?
So there's Frontenac Noir, Gris, and Blanc. We're right now drinking Frontenac Gris.
Yep.
It is, you know, Gris in its definition is gray skinned, but when these grapes phenolically ripen, which means its colors have already gone through veraison, which is like the coloration of the grape. And then, phenolically ripening is when its aromas on the skins and in the fruit develops. When they become phenolically ripe, the grapes start to turn, like pink and gray, and it's beautiful and delicious. However,
it's got a very like Pinot Gris color profile to it, like Ramado-y style.
Yeah, this looks properly orange. It seems like a lot of people, even when they're doing skin contact Gris, find themselves with an orange wine. This is properly amber. Okay. I'm not necessarily seeing anything pink. I'm getting very like amber honey. Mm-hmm.
It's funny, like a cultural difference between Vermont, like any winemaker closer to New York City would call this an orange wine because they would make a lot more money. calling this a rosé is a very, it's a fun look into a different kind of mindset.
That's absolutely a stance.
This is really, really, really lovely. It's got this acid profile that's kind of like, I almost said swashbuckling, but it keeps on, you feel the presence in your mouth moving around quite a lot.
What I'm surprised from this is that the acid structure, Frontenac is well known for having off the charts acidity. Perhaps because this is a 2019 bottling, the acid might have had some time to calm down.
Yeah,
but
it's not like rip your face.
All of the other examples of Frontenac that I've tasted have had off-the-charts acid.
Well, I mean, this good is news, like, for you, Kevin. We have a lot of front and back this season.
I think that this is also something we touch upon in National Wine in general, but the idea that, like, a lot of the people who are making the hybrid wines that we are going to be drinking this whole season are people who have been doing this for less time than, frankly, people from any other region we've ever covered. Mm-hmm. And don't really have a lot of the liberty to allow things to sit in a bottle for a bunch of years before release.
Certainly.
And it's, so when you could find something like this, this is sort of uncharted territory. It's like, what does Frontenac Gris, you know, from La Garagista taste like after 3 years in bottle?
And I think that we don't have to be hyper-focused on necessarily a producer who's making these wines if we are talking about the context where we can taste many different examples of it naturally from these areas. We can taste things from places near each other and find those similarities as well and say, what does this region of organically farmed Frontenac taste like in Vermont after a couple years in the bottle?
Well, this is very interesting because, like,
We don't believe in terroir.
No, but, like, I do believe that if there is such a thing as terroir, that it is way more influenced by the people who are around other people. And absolutely. So, like, we're talking about New England, and obviously we talked about Deirdre already, but, like, she is such a, like, singular kind of presence in this certainly. World. I think everyone we're tasting today is one or two steps removed from her orbit.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? So it's... If anything, that's the fucking terroir here.
It reminds me of Poverty Lane Orchards. Steve, what's
in New Hampshire?
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh my
fucking Christ!
Oh my
Jenny
God!
Jenny is screaming.
I'm screaming at myself. Okay, we can do this.
What are you?
Poverty Lane Orchards. Steve Wood. Their cider is called. This is the most. This is the only thing I'm going to cut. This
it's embarrassing because I should possibly know.
It is Farnham Hill. It reminds me a lot of Farnham Hill in that every single fucking producer we've tasted, we're going to taste this entire season, with the exception of the Europeans, is at least aware of a La Garagista and has probably tasted some of the wines.
And if they can afford it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the wines are phenomenally expensive, which is its own thing. But the other thing is, you know. Everybody has tasted Farnham Hill if you're making cider in the United States. And it's weird that these pop up in these kind of very out of the way places. Like the cider and the hybrid thing. I know you said you don't want to kind of talk about that, or you don't want to think about it because it's scary, but there is a real connection of just like, hey, there's other shit we can ferment and it's popping up in marginal areas. Like you know, you can grow Riesling in the Finger Lakes. So people grow Riesling.
Can you?
You can't grow good Riesling in the Finger Lakes. You can't grow it organically that often, so you probably can't grow it, but that's...
That is, I think, the bigger thing that we're going to keep talking about, is that sort of the promise, I think, of farming hybrid grapes is that we can hopefully... be farming grapes that allow us to farm less manipulatively. And because these grapes were developed to grow here, you know what I mean? That they were, or at least more closely related to a grape that is natively from this continent.
When the month I spent not doing podcasts with you, Kevin, I did a lot of soul searching. And I also talked to a lot of hybrid wine growers. And the thing that came up like so often was one, they're like, please, 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 please don't do your Sancerre bullshit to us. Just be mean to someone else. And I was like, yeah, okay.
The weird thing is while you were gone, I had multiple people I'd never met come up and be like, oh, I know your podcast. I really like the Sancerre episode, which is our first episode.
It's the best episode we've ever done.
Believe that it's the only episode they ever listened to.
Oh, yeah, because they listened to that. Like, yeah, it's not that good. And then the other thing that came up was like, so many people were talking about PVs and hybrid grapes, not just because of the flavor profile, not just because, like, you know, for like aesthetic reasons, but because like I want to grow organically and this is my only way of doing it. Yeah. So it's weird how like natural wine has kind of spawned its own demise in a way. Like the end of vinifera is going to be from the natural wine crowd, which is beautiful, I think.
Well, when you think about it, though, the end of all of this is because because of colonization and globalization. I mean, like, if Europe doesn't take over a fucking continent and bring back phylloxera to Europe, I mean, that's what led to all of this happening. You know, it goes that far back, right? Like, so in a lot of ways, it's like we can't help but always be our own worst fucking enemies and destroy ourselves.
It's no surprise I am my own worst enemy.
We started this and we're going to fucking end it. Yeah. So we are taking an interlude between Frontenac A and Frontenac B with interlude of Itasca, which is from our main vineyard, Char Vineyard, in Concord, New Hampshire. This is a breeding of Frontenac Gris that we just drank. It's been hybridized to have less acid, but still hold the same flavor profile. I'm getting a bit more peachiness.
Yeah, way more fruit.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Is there a term for hybrids that are massaged? Like, is it... Because you don't call them another hybrid. Is it just like a second generation, third generation?
They're all called hybrids. Because even some... Like, even Frontenac is... That parentage, it's cross, 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 cross.
Yeah, I call it a DJ times. Remix. Okay. Yeah.
Taylor's version.
So
that's delicious.
Yeah, Itasca is really good, and you should search it out. It's only been released since 2017. Itasca.
Itasca.
Cool. So
ooh, more of that.
Yeah, Itasca is really tasty, and. Again, it's only been released since 2017, and this is the first bottling of Itasca that our vines have been able to produce. That those were vines that were planted at our vineyard in 2017, and this is like the very early iterations. I just want to make sure that I can get it in front of you guys, and that you know how to compare it next to Frontenac Gris, which was, again, for the purpose of breeding out the high acid. But this Lupo in Bocca Lagerigista Frontenac Gris is absolutely incredible and does not have that high of acid. I'm very surprised by. I'd also just love to say that Deirdre is an amazing winemaker, incredibly knowledgeable farmer, excellent person, and I'm really honored to call her a friend. Shout out to everyone at Lagarigista, Camilla, who we're going to taste her wine later,
Willa, it's like a big tent, it
Caleb,
seems so
everybody
far.
Out there. Yeah, it's a huge tent. I mean, relatively speaking.
I just went back to the Frontenac, and it's crazy. It's a little bit sharper acid, but like it's really holding it well, and I do think that's got to be age. And I wonder what it must be like to be like the flagship producer of a region, but also because you still have to... pay your bills to have very little say over when your wines are released. Yeah. Like very few people can hold their fucking wines back. And that's like, again, like, you know, I don't want to be like, ooh, this went to Europe. I went to Character, the wine festival, and I met like tons of natural wine producers. And everybody acknowledges we are selling our wine too fucking early, but I can't do shit about it.
What do you want me to fucking do?
Yeah, like, do you want my kids not to eat? They have to have bread and cheese 6 times a day.
I can only feed them this jug of Grillo.
This does have a very... It's not like... I was talking earlier about how I more and more like Chenin that's not acid, like rip your face off, and is more textural. And
you like those woolly birds.
Yeah, this has got a wooliness. It's really, really nice. Woolly. it's not necessarily Chenin-y, but there is something that reminds me of like that kind of woolly textural.
The first time I ever tasted Itasca, I really got that that element of like kind of Savignine, Chenin, a bit more acid and structure to it, but also like, you know, it had the Chenin stuff, it had the Savignine stuff, it had the Gewürztraminer stuff, which are all my favorite white grapes.
Have you had Albarine, not Albarino, Albarine from Spain?
No.
It's probably Savignine, but planted in Porto de Fuck.
It probably
it's
has an easier
DO. It's like the newest DO in Spain.
Yeah, it's come through to Porto.
No more Muslims. Yeah. Despacito.
This sort of reminds me of that because you're like, this is like if Savignine wasn't like kinky.
And also had an easier time ripening if it's growing in Spain, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
I think those two things are related. Yeah. you know, what's funny, and like, I don't like to say we're on trend too often, but like very realistically,
just judging by all the wines we got, we could not have done this last year. Mm-hmm. And very likely, if we do this in 3 years, it's going to be an entirely new feel. Like, this is, like, not that, like, hybrids are new, yada, 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 but more like they're coming online and professionalizing really fucking fast.
They're called hybrids, and your kid might be drinking them.
Your kids might be drinking them if your kids are, like, have $14 for buy the glass. Yes. This is Calche. This is the Touch of Noir. We have to say nice things because we're going to do a residency up there this summer. I've been invited 3 times, so we're going to go.
Okay.
So Calche is also one of those things.
The wine's the best wine of the night.
Calche is Calche is a worker-owned cooperative in Vermont that kind of also just popped up like late last year. And
we tasted them at Wild World.
We tasted, barrel sample of this wine. Yeah.
I was actually in Vermont the day that they were doing their release party, but missed out because I had no idea what was going on. But
I know that feeling.
There's just so much that goes around sometimes, and it's you just take a moment to rest, and you miss so much. But it's fine because I'd honestly rather rest and then come back to it. The wine is a slow process.
I'll drink when I'm dead. Yeah.
So this is the Touch of Noir. This also has Frontenac in it. Do you remember what is the other thing in it?
It's Marquette. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to the Marquette phase of today. What's interesting, I think, about Calche is everything about them. They have such a good story, and they have such an interesting, like, the worker cooperative in Vermont. They could make bad wine, and they would still be beloved. Mm. And the fact that they're making really good wine warms the cockles of my fucking heart. Like, this is so fucking delicious, and it doesn't need to be. No one's even asking it to be good. Like, it's, like, a cooperative. They're new. Like, they're throwing a bunch of ideas, and, like, you know, the wine label has a phrase, decolonization of big wine in the back. It's just like, you could, it's weird to have someone be like, oh, we're ethical and it also tastes good. But also that's because I've met so many Europeans.
Well, we can't say canonically that all wine that we enjoy is do no wrong.
It's evil to like wine.
Yeah. I think the folks at Calche really have a good direction for where they want to put their energy in winemaking. It's definitely focusing on doing good outside of the world of wine. They care a lot about equality and justice and progression. You know, it's like just mental progression for all of us, and advocation for people who need it, and support. You know, this is one of the few wineries that that I've seen implement a support system for the people working in it to an extent of, oh, you want to work here, or you want ownership of something, you can do that with this work,
right?
You need advocacy for something, we can provide it to you with those resources. And again, it's like wine is just a thing that gets shared. It's farmed, it's fermented, and it's shared, but it's not without people. It's almost never without people.
Basically, it's stored labor, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you labor to farm.
Damn, I love that.
Turn it into a product that will last. You might as well be, you know, canning peaches or something. It's the same idea, essentially. It's like, how can I make this thing I worked really hard
for last
a season last for when it's fucking cold out? And, like, if you're going to do that already and you're starting from scratch and you're starting in New England and you're starting with hybrid grapes, like, why wouldn't you start that in a way that was the most equitable possible? Because you're starting from fucking ground zero.
Yeah. Right?
So it's amazing to that they were able to notice that and have the fucking wherewithal to say, like, hey, seeing as we're starting from scratch, what if we built this directly on the best possible ideals? Because you can't go to, you know,
the castle.
Yeah, you can't go to the fucking DRC and be like, hey, you guys need to like change everything you've done for hundreds of years and be ethical now. They're gonna be like, well, you know, it is hard in France, is different.
No, I mean, we are going to go canonically. We will go, but we will not be asking.
Yeah, we will not be asked back.
No. Both things are true.
I think we should be yelling about more important things, yeah, anyways.
Yeah. There's nothing more important than wine.
Certainly.
Yeah, I fucking love this.
This is juicy as hell.
Yeah.
And it's like, I was talking earlier before John got here because he was very late. And I was mentioning to you, I had a party. I forgot to invite John. Yeah. In Beacon on Sunday. And
really?
It's Memorial Day weekend. We barbecued. And
I was there last Memorial Day weekend, wasn't I?
Oh yeah, you were.
Oh,
well,
cool.
We didn't invite anyone not from Beacon. Sorry, okay, it's cool. Sort of like an exclusive thing.
Remember when that dog ate the fish?
Yeah, that was cool.
That was so fucking cool.
Was it like
there were a lot of dogs?
It cooked or out of someone's pond?
No, it was cooked.
It grabbed a fish off the grill.
I was imagining like upstate New York koi pond.
No, no, absolutely not. No, a person who came to my party who I actually didn't even know and is not a wine person brought a Paquette. And was like, oh yeah, we just went and picked this up from Wild Ark. We just went and picked this up from this guy Todd. And I was like, oh, are you in wine? And they're like, no. I just think it's like tasty. I was just like, oh, like I kind of had my mind blown, but like that this from Calche has a similar sort of aesthetic, which is like this is fucking juicy and crowd pleasing, mm-hmm. and like you don't need to know jack all shit about mm-hmm. anything to enjoy it. It's just instantly pleasurable.
And it also tastes like wine. I think mm-hmm. that a lot of these things that I said it before to John, but the coolest thing about hybrids and one of the most important aspects of hybrids is that you are tasting new flavors. Mm-hmm. You are tasting different flavors that you're used to in wine. And you can also see it as a product that's still validly wine. It's still, I guess, canonically wine.
Right. Well, to your point, and another thing we talked about before John got here.
Jesus, was about, I was like 15 minutes late.
We did the whole podcast before you got
cider,
here.
And you were like, well, yeah, because the problem, the thing that cider is always going to butt up against is it's people thinking of it as a beer alternative mm-hmm. and blah, blah, blah. And there is something that will, I think, always hold cider back and that people are like, well, it's not wine.
Well, I think
and
the problem
this is in, this is, I think cider is wine, but mm-hmm. like, I don't have to start by having that argument mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. discuss a hybrid one.
I think that zooming out further back is that there are many more things that are by definition mm-hmm. wine. If wine is not the definition of only grapes,
right.
then there can be so much more that we can call wine. We can right. call multiple fruit ferments
yes.
wine.
We can beer call wine. Who gets a fucking shit?
I mean, honestly, okay, so I'll touch on this last, but I mean, I had some birch sap with mm-hmm. sumac in it from Fable.
Oh.
And you can call that wine.
Sure.
That's
with
you can have
with
mead.
Alcohol or not?
It has like 4% alcohol. I think
had some fermented birch sap without alcohol recently.
Oh, interesting.
It was good.
Nice. Yeah.
It's from the Czech Republic.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So when
you
we
tell me about this sap conversation, I'm feeling left.
Yeah.
I'm feeling like a sap.
We're sapping your vital fluids, bro.
when we look at like what is wine actually? We can say wine is anything that's a fermented fruit, perhaps, or even not necessarily fruit.
Right.
We're just taking things from nature and fermenting it into alcohol because it gives us sugar, yeah. and it will naturally do that.
Kimchi is wine. Sourdough is wine.
No, because we're taking cabbage and we're adding other ingredients sure. to it. That's more.
So kimchi
of,
is beer.
Kimchi is closer to beer.
Okay, but is a hot dog a sandwich, guys?
Okay. Well, something I think we're kind of in dancing around is that we're also kind of straddling, like, this is the most professionalized episode we're going to have this season, like, by far, just because, like, this is the longest running, like, hybrid collective zone. And we've got wines that are fitting different categories. Like, Dieter's wines are about, they're generally, like, $45 to $60 mm-hmm. and are very much like statement pieces. These are wines that you will drink at a restaurant in this situation. Like if you are finding an American hybrid wine somewhere in Paris, it is one of her wines, hands down. Yeah. Well, the Calche wines are like, we talked to Justine very much about it. Like, she's like, we're trying to make sure our wines don't get that expensive so people can drink them.
Right.
So these aren't meant to be like a...
them.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
So that they can be drank kind of in a situation like whenever.
Right.
And it's a huge difference.
Yeah. It's more like, I don't want to say democratic, but yeah, this the good version of democratic.
Yeah. Republic.
It is very much more communistic.
Yes.
Yeah, that felt better.
And it's like, it's interesting that this region can support it. Because like something I've seen, just like looking at all the other episodes this season, is the wines are all about the same price. They're all the same idea. And they're going to, I mean, like, I think in the market, if they were all picked up, there'd be a little bit of cannibalization. This is a mature wine region that people, like, Vermont is going to be leading the... New England's gonna be leading the charge for whatever happens in the future on this, just because like also, there are strata.
There also was maybe a free lane in a way that like when we talk about when we've talked in the past about like the Finger Lakes and what could happen there and what's holding it back. A lot of what holds, I think, Finger Lakes as a wine growing region back is like they bought in to an idea 30, 40 years ago that they were going to be the next, like, America's Germany. And they're so fucking pot committed to that idea that they're like, well, we can't fucking give up on it now. Like, all our money is invested in maintaining that truth. So anything that challenges that isn't like, say, a podcast comes to town.
And we did a good job. We did a great job opening minds at that thing.
But it's like, you know, in Vermont, like, yes, you have the, obviously, the hindrance of people being like, wine from Vermont or wine from New Hampshire? Like, huh?
I think that there has been an established validity with enough attention paid to Vermont, as well as the availability of these grapes, the historically established plantings of these vineyards. That's not to say that other places don't have it. It's just that there were not enough people approaching it with the intention of honesty and not finding themselves in a market that responded to it at all. In Vermont, there was a market that responded to
right.
it, and there was then a demand for it.
Vermont is crunchy as shit.
Vermont,
people are prepared to go all the way.
So if we're gonna kind of like break down the vibes of New England, Vermont is...
Thank God, we've been waiting.
So Vermont is essentially the Piedmont of New England.
Oh my God.
New Hampshire is the south of the north with the tallest mountain. Maine is America's Ireland.
Yes, that's very cool.
Boston is the hub of the universe. The rest of Massachusetts can be broke down into many different sections.
None of which should survive.
Starting from furthest western Massachusetts, it's like hippie farmers. And then when you get into the college belt, it's...
the college belt? Jesus, God.
There's a college belt.
It's like the worst fantasy novel.
On the north of it, I have this whole silly map that like really breaks it down, and I'll show it to you later. But as you go more inland, as you go more towards the ocean, I'm sorry, then it becomes like very suburban. The eastern basin of Massachusetts is very low, not very good for growing grapes, but people still do it commercially. That's why you don't find much organic wine in Massachusetts for the most part, because people, quote unquote, can't farm organically, which is not true. I farm organically in eastern Massachusetts, and it's very possible. It's easier to do when you're closer to the ocean because of lower disease pressure from constant oceanic breeze. As you go further down, you know, Rhode Island, it's very small. There's still grapes growing there, where people reportedly talk weirder and drive worse than Massachusetts.
Sounds impossible, but yes, it is true.
Yeah.
They're also somehow more corrupt.
Talking about...
Most donut shops per capita of any state in the Union.
Talking about Cape Cod and the islands, because that's also its own separate section of things where grapevines are also being grown. It has its own AVA.
We make wine in Nantucket. They call it
Martha's Vineyard.
I don't have the full story of Martha's Vineyard, but
I don't know why it's called that, but it doesn't have... I do remember it's like has nothing to do with grapes.
It's probably a really cool
story. Yeah.
It's about whales or something.
I don't remember.
I am like sucking this wine down.
Yeah, this one.
We have moved on to the next wine after Calche. We are drinking a Marquette Petnat. Is that
true? This is Lilith Wines. The cuvée I was told in an Instagram DM, and I passed it to you guys, and I don't remember from
what it was called.
Yeah,
I can check my DMs.
Cool. I mean, I texted you this earlier today.
Okay, yeah,
we're clearly very good at telling other people's narratives.
No, I think it's okay. This is the first vintage of this, and this does barely exists. I think
just to me.
Yeah.
What's the cuvée called? Apéro.
Apéro.
100% Marquette from Stella 14's Vineyard in Cambridge, Vermont. Does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, I had some Stella 14 most recently. I went to Vermont to pick up some wine and to meet Justine. They are excellent. They're just so excellent. Justine, you're awesome. And it was great to meet you and get to talk with you. After that, I picked up some Stella 14 and drank one of their Frontenac Gris Marquette co-ferments.
Oh, cool.
Which was also very tasty. I definitely got a lot more acid from the Frontenac Gris. With this Marquette, it tastes very... now that we're in full Marquette, we can now start to talk about the flavor profile
of
Marquette.
The Pinot Noir of hybrids.
Before we do that, I just must say that Martha's Vineyard is... Cape Cod is White Florida. Martha's Vineyard. Which one was White Caribbean? Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket?
Martha's Vineyard has a much larger black population than Nantucket.
Right. Okay. So it's Massachusetts Caribbean, yeah. And Nantucket is just a boomerang that people like put houses on.
Yeah, that's where I'm from. I'm from the boomerang.
And then
I love this.
And then
down under.
Yeah, we're Australia, basically.
And then. As far as Connecticut goes, it is their slogan.
Not real.
Their slogan. Their like what you see on their state sign is Connecticut still revolutionary. Don't you forget, we are still like very colonial. We still have that vibe. I consider it to be the butt cheek of New England, yeah. And fight me if you will. My Instagram is Renaissance Williams.
So this is like if you dipped a Pop-Tart into a Lambrusco.
I like that you said Pop-Tart because there is a little bit of a creamy note to it.
Jammy, creamy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been because I was in Europe recently. I started buttering my toast before I put jam on it. Yeah, I've also been eating toast. I started eating toast again. I'm having carbs in the morning, Kevin.
Good.
Yeah, I'm having a real identity crisis. I normally have a very protein-rich breakfast, but now I've been having, you know, butter and toast with my coffee. I keep thinking of the word lactic, but I also know that when you talk about lactic in wine, it's a negative quality, but also I think we're throwing the fucking rules out. This is really refreshing, and there is like a little bit of raw butter tang to this.
You know what I'm realizing is someone also brought one of the Opera Lambruscos to my party, and it, late at night, it was a little like more tannic than I wanted it to be at that time, and I started pouring a pamplemousse LaCroix into it, and yes. It was so fucking delicious, and this sort of is reminding me of that too.
Now, the winemaker is really into alternative economics, and so she posts these
like NFTs?
The craziest NFTs, the craziest memes, and I'm just like, all right, let's fucking go.
I only saw a picture of Lilith circulating around Maine. I had not known of her presence until like last week.
Really, I believe it's a Garagista devotee. She's been working kind of under, I think she's like an under winemaker there. And part of like, I think a new collective, there's like three or four new winemakers who are getting minted this year, it seems. This is, she tasted with James at the Portland Wine Festival. That was good, except there was a COVID outbreak. Interesting. I think this really is so fucking confident of a wine. And I have drank like six glasses of it so far, which is rare for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is truly a delicious Marquette that, has incredible lightness to it. Yeah. I think the thing about Marquette is that in super ripe years, like if you try to directly press Marquette, it is going to be very high sugar juice that will take, speaking from experience, like multiple years to ferment down to dry. This is a really tasty pet nat that it seems like a lot of people, especially in Vermont, and we're going to switch to the next wine that is another Marquette
color.
From Camilla. Shout out to Camilla of La Montañuela. People in Vermont seem to be making their Marquette without stems. I'm not sure how Lilith has chosen to ferment ferment their Marquette.
The state can, you guys can have that. You can call it Vermont.
Yes. So what you're tasting this is a 2020 destemmed Marquette. And this is made by Camilla. The next one we're going to try is another 2020 Marquette with the inclusion of stems, and you will be able to taste the difference. Right now, what I want us all to acknowledge is the color of Marquette skins is one of those things that when I say that, like, with hybrids, you have new wine drinking experiences, you are tasting new dynamics, you are seeing new dynamics. This tannic structure, this tannic color is like purple. It's magenta purple. Yes. Marquette,
it's like cartoon character wine.
Yeah, Marquette has that, and it's neon tannins. As well as its flavor profile can be super intense in that same way. Its color is indicative of its flavor.
It's reminding me of like there were some like garnachas from the Grados that were sort of like that Ariana brought in. That were sort of similarly like densely purple and very richly flavored like this.
Well, I'm thinking about Mondus because these are like super bruisery, very tannic, very, very, but big and red, but also quite low alcohol. No, this is probably clocking in 11-12.
This is 12.5, and really? I would not say that. Lots of other hybrids tend to have relatively lower alcohols because their peak ripeness is actually at a lower sugar content.
Got it.
Most grapes are going to be anywhere from 20 to 25 Brix. That's the measurement of sugar that people measure to see like how much sugar they have in the density of their liquid and how much alcohol is going to come out of that. So anywhere from like 20 to 25 is going to be anywhere from like 11 to 14% alcohol, which is the usually normal threshold for wine generally. That's to say that the first wine we had was around 10% because it was underripe, as well as Labrusca and other hybrids like that. They do ripen at a lower sugar. We weren't tasting super underripe flavors from it because perhaps it was meant to be at that sugar for its more peak ripeness, or at least it's closer to there. With Marquette, it was hybridized to withstand cold temperatures and still ripen.
Right.
And Marquette can get super high sugar. Marquette can get as high as like 26 Brix and make you 15% alcohol wine. That is what we are about to drink next. This is much more balanced. It's 12.5% alcohol, which is to suggest that maybe it was picked at a normal Brix count, like around 21, 22.
Yeah.
What's so funny is I've had so many people... My struggles with I phoned a lot of friends for the season. Like I was like, you know, I haven't had the greatest experience of a lot of hybrids. And I think that is okay because I think a lot of them were not weren't making wine. You know, we did this. I explained my thoughts here, but this was the wine that everyone kind of said this is going to be your keystone. I've had so many people say like this is one of the finest hybrids I've ever had. And also probably one of the finest like northeastern. I'm really trying to struggle to find a red wine from the northeastern United States that I like more than this.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if I sell any that I have to shout out, and I don't. This is better. This is fucking phenomenal.
While you think about that and discuss, I'm going to go pee. You don't have to pause.
I was going to say, this is probably going to be like one of my dad's favorite episodes because...
We're explaining everything?
Well, Ryan is explaining everything, which we never fucking do.
My parents almost nudge him, like, you don't have to do that. No, like, maybe actually we should be
doing this. And like, My parents like to listen to the podcast when they're driving back and forth from Florida. They love it. Every time they're like, and they remember everything from every episode more so than I remember because I don't ever listen to them. And the one thing is always my dad's like, I was a little confused about like what that word bricks meant. I was like, oh yeah, we didn't stop and say what bricks meant, huh? Now he knows. This is great.
Don't get spoiled, Kevin's mom and dad. We will not be doing this ever again. This is your only opportunity to learn shit on our stupid podcast. I'm obsessed with, like, I really like this grape.
Hello, yeah. Yuma. Well, I think also, like, I really like this quote that I've read from her where, I forget where I've read this article, but it said, Carilla recalled being dogged by people who said that if she wanted to make wine, she would need a college education in chemistry.
Jesus fucking Christ.
But she knew in her bones that continuing to travel, interning at wineries, blah, 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 was the best path for her. But I just, like, love that. That, like, I wrote that quote down because it feels like if you're going to commit yourself to a world of making, quote-unquote, real wine in America, I think it certainly does behoove you to have, like, an education at UC Davis or something, because you do have to fucking learn, like, how to, you know, test for this and make sure you're adding this at the right time for that. But, like,
are you saying you agree with that in any way?
No, I'm actually saying that in, like, an ironic way. Yeah. Like if you want to make wine that is trying to adhere to a preconceived notion of what wine needs to be, then perhaps you are better served by getting that education. But if you are starting from the premise that there isn't necessarily a wrong way to make wine as long as it tastes good and that it's honest farming and that that's the place where you start, then I think that that's a lot less fucking important.
I think I do think that the most important place to start with is the honesty of the winemaking. There are far too many people who make commercial wine based on a recipe that they either learned somewhere else or were trying to do it with the intention of making a different wine. I also think that while Marquette is good, the people making it are good winemakers making good wine, and I have yet to try a properly bad natural Marquette that doesn't
I'll let you know
taste
in 7 weeks.
Too honest. There is Marquette out there that is. I've had bad Marquette. I just haven't had bad
dishonest.
Honest. No, I've had dishonest Marquette, that and that's the kind of Marquette that was bad. Right. But I haven't had bad honest Marquette.
Yeah.
I also think
I'm fucking obsessed with this wine.
I also think that the flavor profile of Marquette is very specific. It's not that it's one note; it's just a very specific note. I think that even when it's underripe, Marquette tends to taste like a bit of a tart yet hot raisin.
Yeah. There's a reason. And that's why I was talking about those garnaches from the Great Oast.
That's so interesting.
Sort of like, it was like sort of not raisinated, but just almost hinting at the idea of dried fruit in the flavor profile and sort of in the richness. And this is reminding me of that a little bit.
You know what I'm thinking about so much right now? I'm thinking of our friend Regan from South Hill. South Holt. Jesus. How interesting it would be like if he was still in New York or if he had started his project a couple of years later, what he would have done with hybrids.
Right.
Because like a lot of his wines taste very similar to like there's a certain kind of like edginess that really reminds me. And maybe that's just agriculture up here. Maybe it's just making your red wine in places that like red wine is not always guaranteed.
I think that again, as I said at the beginning, a lot of mentalities of New England winemaking, people find it to be very sweet and commercial tasting in that way.
But that's a choice.
And if people are making red wines, they're trying to make it as serious as possible, and it ends up all tasting
Big
like really
wines.
Bad. Yes. Yeah. And specifically in my experience of Big Dad wines, I have tasted lots of things that taste like like flabby coffee grounds mm-hmm. because it's over-extracted. It's yeasted to shit. It's sulfured to shit. It's just dead. Ooh. It tastes like dead ink to me, essentially. All tannin, no nuance or fruit or life within the fermentation. With these things, within the natural and honest context, we can still get things that are big, but we also have to accept the other things that come with it,
right.
Like either high acid mm-hmm. or some particular fruit flavor profiles that we don't agree with. Marquette was created, it was bred in Minnesota in 89, and it was only released in around 2000.
That's so crazy.
It is a great breeding is just generally
a blueprint.
Mm-hmm. It's generally a 20-year process from crossing to releasing.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of like kids, right? You get your cross and then you release them 18 years later.
Yeah, you say you are at a general mm-hmm. threshold, which we accept to be released into the public. good luck. Don't be bad.
Don't be bad. You can be tried as an adult.
Yes.
You've undersold this wine. This is a real fucking humdinger, as
so
they would say.
The essentially final wine of this lineup.
I don't like
lineup.
The sound of that word essentially.
The final wine of this lineup.
I don't like the word final, though.
Both
the
of
last
you
wine you'll ever
shut
taste
up. The last wine we are going to taste in this episode is the highest alcohol.
Oh, wait, we've been recording this. This is the practice round.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. This is the Marquette that we farmed together, Nico and I, in New Hampshire. Ooh. This was the year before I joined in, so this was entirely Nico's first mm-hmm. year of fully taking this vineyard that was planted in 2012 with Marquette, and making it fully farmed and fermented organically. No added yeast. This actually has no added sulfur either. No added sugar, no added anything. Nothing added, nothing taken away. Unfined, unfiltered, unfucked with. This is an honest representation for what you can get in a perfect growing season. 2020 in New England was very dry. It was a drought the entire growing season. It might have rained 3 times. Over 4-5 months, maybe. And these growers were able to have very low disease pressure. You are tasting the full version of Marquette in both of these, both the Vermont and these New Hampshire examples.
Yeah, this is like a souped up kind of idea of the last wine, where it still has that semi-raisinated flavor profile. With a little bit more like alcohol heat, a little bit more structure, just a little bit more of everything.
Yes. And I mean, honestly, I think drinking it a little cool makes it nice enough to enjoy on this 95 degree day in New York.
It's ripping.
It is gigantic wine. This is when people say you can't make big red wine in New England. Mm-hmm. This is the wine that you show to prove people wrong. I think that both these examples of Marquette are incredible, and I think it's really educational tasting the difference between destemmed Marquette and whole cluster fermented Marquette. Both of these I believe to be semi-carbonic maceration, which means that you take a layer of grapes on the bottom, you crush it, you put more grapes on top, and you let that carbonically macerate for a short amount of time to extract a light fruit element out of it, and then crush it again with your feet to do full maceration. When you do carbonic maceration, you are essentially taking CO2, covering the grape, and letting it ferment in its own skin. It creates an anaerobic environment, which means that you do not have like air inclusion with that fermentation. You're just taking grapes and you're sealing them up. And lots of people do that mm-hmm. in Beaujolais, mm-hmm. in California, are the
two places.
Two places that they're the only two places, only Beaujolais and California, actually. And they are that creates one side of things, and there are other people who never do any kind of carbonic. They just straight up like crush the grapes. And mm-hmm. I think that extracts the fruit in a different way. It makes more savory fruit. It makes more quote unquote serious fruit. I think that might be the difference of the treatment between mm-hmm. these things. However, we're talking about specifically with Marquette. People have found that the semi-carbonic method of fermentation with these grapes has found to extract the fruit and extract the tannic structure from it in a balanced way. I think that good winemaking is all about balance. And this is still very powerful wine, but it's not like more acid than fruit. It's not more tannin than anything else. I mean, it's high amounts of all three of those things, acid, fruit, and tannin, but it is beautiful and big.
It's a big boy.
It's, you know, we talked about on this podcast in the past, like this idea of terroir being an accumulated knowledge or an accumulated capital over mm-hmm. time, right? These two things that happen to create the idea of what wine from a place tastes like. It's like, oh, well, they've made wine in Burgundy for this many years mm-hmm. this way, and therefore that's what Burgundy tastes like. And what we're talking about here is a grape that literally has only existed for 20 years mm-hmm. being planted in the wild, right? And has only really been experimented with for maybe the last 10 of people mm-hmm. being like, well, what if I did no
stuff? What if I real wine?
This is really early on trying to figure out what it is this grape does in this place.
There are a lot of people who will treat this like any other grape, and I think that that's also the story of this vineyard that we're tasting from right now. Shara Vineyards, formerly known as Mermaid Hill Vineyard, was planted in 2012 with Marquette, and the previous winemaker had been making this wine via essentially recipe. Mm-hmm. He added chestnut tannin powder, sugar, yeast, sulfur. And when you taste this wine that has none of those things, you can taste that all of those things perhaps were quite unnecessary, and the reason
perhaps
why
I was thinking it missed a little bit of like chestnut tannin.
Yeah,
powder.
I was actually thinking, yeah, the tannins.
Hints, a Saison,
there's not enough tannins in this wine actually currently.
Wait, you don't like keep a little thing of chestnut tannin like powder like a out little with you. Salt, yeah.
Like, so he's been like just crunching on the flesh of a grimace right now. Your teeth are so purple. It's amazing.
Yeah, I feel perped out of my fucking mind.
Yo, people will do shit like adding color to their wine too.
You should add some purple to this.
You should. 100%, this is not purple enough. No, this is, you could literally like light a neon sign with this fucking wine. If you spill it on a regular lamp, it is a neon sign that you've created. Yeah,
my mouth feels like I got real grimaced. This is nuts.
That is why we're drinking it at the last, the very final of this
is the
lineup.
End of this gorgeous.
This is, I think that the lineup that we tasted here mm-hmm. is a really good introduction to what New England hybrids have to offer. Now, that's to say that there are more hybrids in other places, mm-hmm. but I don't think that anywhere in the United States are hybrids more necessary for the entirety of a region than the very northernmost parts of America, of 100%. The United States of America.
And this makes sense when you think about, like, where are the places mm-hmm. that are developing new hybrids? They're in fucking Ithaca and Minnesota?
The two places.
The only two places next to Beaujolais and California. Two places, you know, like,
a lot of these are coming out of, and it's because they're fucking cold-ass places. And that was an initial idea, is like hybrids could be grown here because it's colder.
When Missouri,
but there's all kinds of other disease pressures, to your point, in the northeast of America that can be challenged by turning towards hybrid grapes instead of spraying the shit out of grapes from fucking Greece.
You can still plant them and they'll still grow. People are doing Baco Noir in mm-hmm. California. People are doing Marquette in Oregon. Mm-hmm.
We've got some California Baco Noir.
Yeah, it's happening out there, and it's all very possible to do anyways, but you know, you'll go to those regions and people will still try to will still try to rationalize planting more vinifera by saying, oh, I can get a few more years out of this. I can still grow vinifera for like 10 more years. There's people who are still like planting vinifera.
Wait till the last minute.
They keep on planting vinifera. There have been vineyards that have died and been replanted with the same things over and over again because people just want the thing to grow there. You can't do like, you can't, I mean, I have heard far too much that people tell me that you can't do such and such. Mm-hmm. Like you can't farm grapes without doing anything. Like you have to spray grapes or apples or anything in order for
you
it to survive.
Spray apples.
And you look at hundreds of year old trees. Mm-hmm. You look, I'm working with 60 year old vines in Boston that I've never had any commercial, like any spray on it. I sprayed it with milk last year. Like to spraying with milk and whey.
I thought it was nothing added, nothing removed.
Okay.
So we've got a little bit of milk added. What else?
Add my foot in your ass. Okay, let's go. So when we are talking about the farming of it, because there's the farming of it and there's the fermentation of it. With farming, it's doing what you know how to make sure that you don't lose all your fruit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's many different iterations of how people farm, and When I'm talking about commercial farming, I am talking about the use of synthetically made chemicals on your vines. There are many other things that people do that I don't agree with that can still be organic, like watering or tilling, and spraying something with like far too much sulfur.
Copper sulfate.
Yes, copper sulfate.
Well, actually, that's our sponsor for today, is copper sulfate. It makes agriculture possible.
We're sponsored by Agway and Plastic.
I promised that I would be the silent alarm block party in these sleeves. And it's been an hour and 31 minutes.
Okay.
I feel like this wine's kind of like eating broken glass.
Is there anything you want to finish with, like, essentially a final thought?
I think that hybrids are becoming more available and more accessible. I think that also there is going to be a problem with people easily accessing it outside of the regions where it is grown because we are small-scale farmers making an agricultural product that is a luxury item, and in order for us to sell it at a price where we can actually make money from it, you're not going to be tasting these things in New York if we only have like 50 cases of it, probably. Unless you get like a case and people are fighting for it, like I don't know,
or if you just start a podcast,
a TV on Black Friday,
you start a podcast and they bring you one,
and
big
yes,
brain thoughts.
Everybody must become a wine podcast now in order to try organic hybrids from New England.
It's a lot harder than it seems. I can tell you what,
this life sucks.
It's the worst.
And a lot of the things that you are going to be able to try that gets into distribution is going to be secondary products like cider piquette that people have seen to do a whole lot more, and that we will also be drinking after this episode is over.
Thank God.
And that you are going to have to come to these places yourself or buy directly from these producers. Vino Shipper is probably going to be your best friend when you do that.
I'm going to try to figure out something. I'm thinking about for every episode posting what's the best way to get these.
Yes.
I'll probably just post links.
And this shouldn't be like a surprising thought to our listeners. We've talked about like when you're talking about domestic producers that you love, like the best way to support them is to buy directly from them.
Or start a wine podcast.
Or start a wine podcast.
For them. Yeah.
And that's to say that my upbringing in wine is from a place of I knew how to get myself into the right room. I didn't know when was the right time, but I am, you know, I have all these different intersections that isn't synonymous with the old way of thinking of wine. I'm a queer farmer of color, and my exposure to these things has just been out of luck and knowing good and quote unquote the right people to guide me to this place. Now I hope to be someone who can represent this, and it's certainly the work that I've been doing for the past year is bringing this to the people and making sure that they can taste it as accessibly as possible. But if you have the means to do so, go to Vermont and try these things yourself, although it's more easy to find wines from Vermont in places like New York because the demand for it has provided a space for it to exist here. As we make more in New Hampshire, as I try to personally convert wine grape growers in Massachusetts to switch to organic and farm and ferment organically, you're going to be finding a lot more small-scale producers that cannot distribute. You're not going to find their wines in California. You're not going to find their wines even below the Mason-Dixon line, probably. You are going to find incredible, incredible wines being grown and drank in their specific regions, just like any old world, quote-unquote, old world wine story, how there are amazing producers you know about, but you've never had their really good stuff because we don't have the infrastructure yet to be drinking amazing wines like this very far away. You're going to have to come to it yourself for now or buy it directly from the person, which is not as gratifying as going there and picking it up yourself, either at a store or at the winery, but you should do that anyways. Vermont agricultural tourism, New Hampshire agricultural tourism, Maine agricultural tourism, all things you should do. For Maine specifically, go visit Mafka, Maine Heritage Orchard. They're doing lots of apples there. I have yet to see lots of grapes happen, but I believe that
there's
is going
really
to be
blueberry
down.
Blueberry wine out there that blueberry we almost did on happening. This episode, but I figure there is... We can just talk
we'll
about
it. We'll do a blueberry season.
We'll do a blueberry. Honestly, we're going to do a blueberry season in two
Your
fucking
mouth's
years.
Doing our goddamn blueberry season yeah. right now.
I need to drink water really bad.
In New Hampshire, come to Shara Vineyards in Concord, New Hampshire. It is accessible without a car if you so choose to do so. But if not, again, we are in Concord, New Hampshire. Shara Vineyards, S-H-A-R-A. My name is Ryan Williams. We technically do not work for this vineyard anymore, but we are running our winery out of the space under NOK Vino, not otherwise known. That is what it stands for. You can find us on Instagram at NOK Vino. You can find me on Instagram at Renaissance Williams. I am the quote unquote quality control of all these operations. I'm just
you're
very
always
bougie.
Here too.
Well, I'm bougie and opinionated in New York every other weekend. So.
And you just like as we wrap up, you sort of self-deprecatingly were like, oh, because of luck, I found myself in these places. But you're one of the most like tenacious people I've ever met. And
no, thank you.
The first time I think I met you, you just like walked up to me and were like,
you're wrong.
No, I said, here's some Marquette. Also, said, keep my name out of your fucking mouth. Back's wrong, which you do all the time still. Oh, yeah. And I have not forgiven you for it. It's but fine. That's okay. We are progressing. Mm. We are growing together.
That's true.
We are tasting more wines from these places. We finally got it all to the same fucking table in the same room.
Yeah.
This might be the most powerful season that you folks listen to yet, hopefully. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, it might be. I've never been optimistic about a fucking season, but yeah, it could be the most powerful season to Scorgeous.
I'm ready for it.
I think the Jura was powerful because I'm obsessed with the Jura and Loire, but I think that what we can speak to here is something that the people who are here can share their stories. I think that it's important that you continue to hold this space just like this because honestly, in this world of wine podcasts, like we can both be unhinged and very precise. Mm-hmm.
We've got part of that down.
Yeah, we're unhinged.
Yeah.
I think that we can also come approach this table with the intention of really acknowledging what's actually going on and not pretending like the way that things have been the entire time, either don't go address because it's convention or that we need to hold respect for certain people or places or things. I love who I love and I have very reserved energy for people who don't deserve it.
I love that.
Come to New Hampshire. We have multiple beautiful vineyards. Nico and I farm five, six different vineyards across New Hampshire. That's around 7 acres. We farm a third of New Hampshire's vines.
Jesus.
That's pretty incredible.
It's me and this other guy. We farm the oldest vineyard in New Hampshire. We farm We farm the largest amount of organic farming, organically farm grapes in New Hampshire. That's our entire philosophy, is spraying organic things like whey, which is a byproduct of milk, which we work with our local cheese producers to get that whey. We spray our vines with all these biodynamic preparations of 500 and all that. That's a conversation that we can totally have after this episode is over, but you should come to us and ask about it, because we'd be happy to talk to you about it with the time that we do have, as well as... that's to say that Nico and I are only two people doing this work, and we need way more support. If you live in New England, if you live in New Hampshire, if you desire to be part of this world, you are absolutely 100% welcome to join us in that work. And if it's for a day, for a week, for longer than that, come see what's going on and help. Because we can't do it alone. And we don't have to. We don't have to. There's enough people. It's just that this needs to not be unknown anymore. This has been the best kept secret.
Yeah.
That New England, New Hampshire natural wine, everybody's hyper focused on Vermont. Mm-hmm. And
New Hampshire's just Vermont upside down. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, New Hampshire is Vermont upside down. Together they make a square. Yeah. Honestly, there's so much more that we'll say off pod about the vibes of New Hampshire, because honestly, there's so much more to be said about it. But I hope that people listening to this can have the idea in their head that this wine is real. It's wine, it's grapes, it's not vinifera, but it's good, and we're going to keep on making it.
Hell yeah. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you so much.
And stay tuned for episode 2.
The most powerful season of Disgorges yet, except for maybe the Jura season, which we invented COVID after that. So. Yeah.
You guys really fucking shat the bucket.
Well, we needed time to chill after that.
All right, bye.
Take it sleazy.
Disgorges.